everybody. Thank you for joining me on another episode of the Lumieres podcast. This one has been a few weeks coming. I recorded about three, I think, before the whole coronavirus thing lockdown hit us. I'm currently unable to go out and record anymore, so I was thinking I'd probably stagger them a little bit more than I usually do. Hence, this one's only the second one to be released in the new run. We'll see what happens after the third one. I'm not quite sure what's going to happen. I might do something completely different to the normal, but that remains to be seen. For now, we're back with another episode today, and my guest is Sam Gandy, Dr. Sam Gandy. He's an ecologist, writer, speaker, researcher, whose special interest lies in examining the capacity of psychedelic substances to dramatically and radically shift our interactions with the natural world. Sam is a scientific assistant to the director of the Beckley Foundation, and he recently collaborated on a groundbreaking study with the Centre for Psychedelic Research guys over at Imperial College in London, where they did the first real study, as far as I'm aware, demonstrating a really robust positive association between the use of psychedelics and resulting nature-relatedness. This is really important because it's not been properly studied. I mean, it's something that anecdotally people would assume might be the case, hence why it's really vital that these kind of studies get done. And I think that's something you'll hear Sam talk about more in the podcast and how he plans to take this further, because we are sort of heading towards, it seems, a period of time where the use of psychedelics in a medical context, or the use of psychedelics for healing modalities, depression, trauma, end of life, anxiety, all this kind of stuff, will hopefully become a reality for many people, not just these people undergoing the trials. And if that is to be a reality, then these kind of scientific studies that prove this stuff really works are very important. So I've been following Sam's work for a while. He's got some great talks on YouTube and from the various Brecken Convention conferences. And he was kind enough to let me pop over to his homestead to record this conversation way back at the end of January. Now, this was recorded, which seems like a whole other world away. But we had a great chat. And as you'll hear, Sam is a very intelligent and switched on dude, and he really knows his stuff. And I'm sure you'll learn a lot from this conversation. I'm not going to talk about the coronavirus situation because everyone seems to be wanting to weigh in on that and give their opinion on something which I think is kind of really in the early days of developing. And we still don't know what the ramifications are going to be, but it's pretty clear that nothing will ever be the same. And all I'll say for now is I hope you're safe out there. I hope you're taking precautions. We really do need to not overwhelm the health services. Like most of you, I've been through a whole range of emotions with this stuff, fear and anxiety and confusion and escapism and grief and feeling scared, and also feeling quite joyous at the peace and in a way that's sort of bestowed on the land by our enforced lockdown. But I think mostly just feeling for all the people who sadly dying and dying alone. It really brings it home how much work there is to be done on the acceptance of death and the preparedness for death and dying of ourselves and for the loved ones in this culture. And I think that's a really important topic that's being brought up and brought to the surface by what's going on with this pandemic. But I'll leave it there for now. The slowly weaving thread of this podcast, funnily enough, the next episode will be with Sophia Campbell, and she's a weaver, and she weaves weaves coffins. And she's a fascinating person, craftswoman, had some really full-on experiences in her own life as well around this stuff, and we'll talk more about that in the next episode, so look out for that probably in a few weeks' time. And just to say, I recorded a little sound journey last week for the Dardenne blog. You can find the post. There's just a little post and a clip of about a 10-minute improvised sound journey with chimes, kalimba. Just a little offering to help soothe those frazzled edges and bring you back to your body, back to presence, which I think is vital at this time. I'll put the link up under the Connect with Jodi bit on the bottom of the post, but you could also find it at dadeni.org. That's dadeni.org/post/sounds-to-soothe. Sounds to soothe. I do hope you enjoy that. Just want to say a big thank you to Sam for being a very gracious host and his time and his presence and his energy. Go out there and absorb some of the wonderful stuff that he's been putting into the world. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing. And thank you for practicing social distancing. Stay safe. Breathe deep. Much love.
I guess the first thing to say is, yeah, I'm very much a kind of nature lover. I've always had a deep connection to and reverence for and found and joy in nature and wildlife. And I guess I kind of funneled that into a kind of academic career. So I've got a master's in entomology, and then that led on then to a PhD in ecological science up in Aberdeen. And I looked at soil regeneration of degraded soils and termites out in Ethiopia. So I spent half a year out in Ethiopia working on that, which was quite an experience. And now that's sort of like now my kind of work... I'm an external collaborator with the Center for Psychedelic Research at Imperial. And my particular area of research interest there is the capacity, the potential of psychedelics to kind of reconnect our species to the natural world. Mm. And so, yeah, recently, like as a result of that collaboration a month ago, we published a paper, and that presented the first empirical evidence of psychedelics leading, sort of having this causative effect on a before and after increasing one's nature relatedness or connection in an enduring way in a healthy population. So this is a naturalistic study. So this is people doing a quite sophisticated online survey before and after and taking psychedelics in the wild, so to speak.
Okay.
And looking not just short term, but then looking long term as well. And it seems that this is a really sort of, persisting effect that stays with people. And I guess, yeah, maybe we'll talk more about that.
Yeah, I definitely want to dig into probably everything you've just said in a bit more detail. So did you feel like you wanted to work in some capacity with nature, within nature from a young age? Or were you kind of, I don't know, what did you want to be when you were little?
Yeah, good question. I think I always sort of had the feeling or knew I wanted to be working in a kind of nature-related capacity. Hmm. That sort of started. I kind of went the scientific route, I guess. And that's been good. It's been challenging as well, but it's been good. But one of the things I kind of like about the Imperial thing now is being a collaborator and getting to do that, but getting to do my other stuff on the side. I kind of see myself more now as a kind of communicator and an engager.
Yeah.
So that I kind of want to be trying, I'm trying to move in that direction now.
Right.
Rather than just doing pure research.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
But that definitely has always been a sort of lifelong thing for me. And I think it always will be. And that's very much sort of the area I want to kind of work in. But that's, yeah, I'm still figuring it out, to be honest.
Yeah,
as I go along.
So you were just talking about the PhD you did.
Yes.
Was that in ecology?
Yes. So for my master's, I did an entomology master's at Imperial, and which turned out to be a good decision. It was a year well spent. Like I managed to get a loan from a local charity here to sort of support me through it. And I ended up just through luck, my tutor, his wife's Vietnamese and he lives out in Vietnam for a good chunk of the year. Mm. And on our first sort of meet and greet, there was free, not very good wine there. And he sort of said to me like, Sam, maybe one day you can come out to Vietnam and do some research there. So I remembered that. I filed that away for the better part of a year. And then when it came to my second project, I got to go to Vietnam to this sort of remote national park in the Nam Cat Tien National Park in the center of the country. And I ended up doing research on termites there.
Oh, right.
Under different sort of...
Was that something you were already into? Or
No, not really.
It was just what they were doing.
Yeah, it was sort of like... It was weird how it happened, because my tutor, he's basically an expert in pesticide application, application of pesticides. So it looked like it was going to be a kind of pest control type deal, and that's not really my thing. I didn't really. I'd rather study things rather than, you know, have to kill them.
Yeah, yeah.
But then it basically, like, there wasn't the time window to do that.
Okay.
And out of desperation, I emailed this Russian scientist had done a study on the termites of the park and published a paper like a year or two before. And I kind of, out of desperation, I kind of emailed him sort of to try and like develop my own idea that wasn't going to be stepping on his toes, what he'd done before. And he emailed me straight back saying, I'm literally 200 meters down the track from where you are, so come and see me and come and chat.
Perfect.
So that kind of lined up well. And then I sort of went and spoke to him, and then I kind of got my idea about looking at the termite community under different land use types and looking at the different ecological functional groups. So not just what termites are there, but what are they actually doing? What's their ecological role in the landscape? Right. And that then sort of led on pretty directly to the PhD at Aberdeen, which was looking at very similar things, actually, but also linking in soil as well. So really, there's really bad soil issues in Ethiopia, so massive soil degradation from, like, the soil's already fragile and it's being kind of mismanaged and overgrazed, and in some areas the soil's just gone, and you've got exposed bedrock. So obviously that's not good for anyone, like wildlife or humans.
Yeah.
So they've got they've kind of put these exclosure areas in, and they've kind of got little walls of rocks and succulents, and sort of there's strict rules in place about how the land is used. And I was there to basically see the effect of, on time, what happens to the soil sort of over various time intervals. So from like year zero to year 20 with about sort of six time intervals, what's going on with the soil and what's going on with the termites. And that was interesting, because we found out there that sort of one of the key things was where the soils are really knackered and the termites are starting to come back, is that because of all their burrowing in the soil, they very much sort of increase the water infiltration in the soil. So for a good 15 meter average, or say radius around these big mounds in the landscape, the water sort of goes into the soil much more quickly than it otherwise would.
Uh-huh.
And obviously that's really important where you're sort of like, where the sort of the soil's quite knackered and you've not got any plants, the fact that the soil is able to kind of hold on to the water rather than the water just washing over the surface, taking the soil with it, that just subtle change can allow plants to get a toehold and get established, and then the ecosystem's basically up and running.
So do they have in places like that where it's really severe, do they have plans in place, or are there people coming in and going, how do we you know, turn this into grassland again, or, you know?
So, yeah, I mean, that's part of the project I was looking at, was this ALTER project. And it was mainly focused on soil carbon, because soil carbon is a good barometer of overall soil health.
Yeah.
And that was the main focus. But no, it was kind of fairly, like, there was the Agricultural Research Institute where I was in Ethiopia. Like, they're pretty switched on in terms of doing applied research on the soils and agricultural practices, which was quite good. But it was fairly sort of, I think the exclosures have been researched for a while, but a little bit kind of haphazardly. So we were there to try and sort of do a bit more of a rigorous job. I didn't actually. I took loads of soil samples, and because of logistical issues, I didn't get to analyze them, because they actually made it back to the UK and then DEFRA rejected them and sent them back to Ethiopia at great expense to the project because of the shoddy state of the box that they came in. So I didn't actually get to the soil continuum, unfortunately. I was pretty, apart from the water infiltration, it was quite a termite-centric PhD.
Right.
But that gave me more than enough stuff actually to look at, to be honest. I think I'd have kind of bitten off more than I could chew had I got those soils back as well. I could have done with an extra year, I think. Yeah.
So what made you want to, what was the kind of, was it a pivot, or how did you see psychedelics coming into your area of research after termites?
Yeah, so it's kind of, it's a bit of a funny, because it doesn't seem so. So firstly, when I was an undergrad, my first year of undergrad my undergrad degree, it was in London. And at that time, psilocybin mushrooms were completely legal.
Same when I was at college.
It was great days. Heady days. and so that sort of, that kind of, previous to that, and I was pretty anti-drug. And I was sort of not really interested, you know.
Throughout adolescence?
Yeah. No, unusual. I was fairly like staunchly like anti and skeptical and sort of, do you know what I mean? It was like, I wasn't really, definitely didn't smoke, wasn't really much of a drinker sort of like, and then, my first mushroom kind of experience was to be, spectacular disaster actually. Kind of went to... had a box of these fresh tubensis mushrooms and got on the tube and went to Fabric, not really knowing what we were getting ourselves into. And so that was a spectacular disaster of a night, but it was a very good learning experience in that the whole set and setting thing, you know, like reading about it and then experiencing it directly. Like, so then I kind of like, it was much more, approach these things with much more respect in terms of set and setting and max.
Yeah, I mean, it's like having a car crash when you're young and then you're like, oh my God.
And then, you kind of know...
These things are crazy. These things need to be really like careful.
Dangerous and there's a lot of power. It kind of, puts you on the straight and narrow a little bit, so to speak. So I don't, you know, I'm still grateful for it, even though it wasn't like diary kind of wow. Like, so I guess the key thing here, how I see that they're linked, is I saw a recent quote by, is it that... Some high-level Buddhist monk, and he was talking about interconnection and the spiritual interconnection of our species and with nature.
Yeah.
And what's really, I really like about that particular spiritual perspective he's describing, is that it very much aligns with what ecological science says.
Yes.
About the interconnection of living systems. Mm-hmm. So I see ecology in a sense as like, it's the detached, objective, intellectual understanding of the interconnection of all things. And psychedelics, kind of their tools for giving direct experiential comprehension of that interconnection.
Sure.
So they're two very different ways of viewing the same thing.
Hmm.
And I think there's really something to be said of value for that direct experiential way of seeing things.
Completely.
I think it's got a place, just like people's connection to nature. Actually, it's interesting, like that connection is much more strongly predicted, well, as in it's much more predicting of pro-environmental behavior, say, than environmental knowledge. So having knowledge of nature, it does have an effect, but it's nowhere near as strong at predicting pro-environmental behavior as your actual emotional, experiential, felt connection.
Sure. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So they're two different forms of knowledge there, but it's the sort of like, the direct emotional component that's the powerful.
Yeah, head versus motivator. Heart, you could say, or perhaps a little bit. You know, someone might have read a load of books about different kinds of plants, but they don't have that kind of one-to-one, man, that plant, I really love
when
nettles,
like,
or, you know.
Picked your, you whatever know, picked it your is. Own plant, like, and sort of interface with the wild directly. So, and obviously science can be quite heady sometimes. Mm. So, and I think it's kind of, it's good to have a kind of more all-encompassing, inclusive view of things. So this is why psychedelics, I think, are useful, powerful tools when it comes to nature connection and the things that stem from that.
So when you talk about the difference between nature immersion and nature connectivity, what are we talking about there?
So I mean, they sound pretty different, and that there's certainly overlap between them. But nature connection or relatedness or connectedness, a few different names to describe it, is effectively a psychological measure of your self-identification with nature, the degree to which you feel part of nature.
Okay.
So, and that's really important because that's associated with a broad, it's a strong predict or strongly correlate with a broad range of measures of psychological well-being and health. So lowered anxiety, increased vitality, life meaning and purpose, positive effect and happiness. So all these different things. It also, importantly, is a mediator for some of the benefits one gets when actually spending time in nature. And it's a strong predictor of pro-environmental behavior as well. So there's a lot going on that's really interesting and beneficial to the individual and to the wider world. Mm. So whereas nature immersion or exposure, which sounds a bit weird, but that's how it's described sometimes, is that sort of comes with its whole other suite of benefits as well. So they are, and like through spending time in nature, we do tend to get more connected to it, perhaps unsurprisingly. So, but they are, different things that sort of overlap to a profound degree.
Do you think, do you think we could make a concrete example of what that looks like? Like, is nature immersion something more where, are you going camping somewhere for a week or?
Yeah, I think that actually is a very good example. Yeah, I mean, so nature immersion, there was a really interesting study. There's been a few big sort of, there's a really interesting study just published by a team in Exeter looking at the effects of green spaces and nature on health. And they found it was a really comprehensive study in terms of its sample size. And they looked at like physical, mental health issues. And they effectively found that 120 minutes of nature per week is like really good. It doesn't matter if you get that time all at once. It doesn't matter if it's dispersed through the whole week.
Sure.
It doesn't matter. You don't have to be in pristine wilderness somewhere. Even like a green, urban green space that's got some like trees and maybe some water and grass. Mm. Like that's still going to be restorative. They also controlled for the effect of exercise out in nature. So it doesn't matter. And they found it doesn't matter if you're just like sitting or lying in it compared to walking around. Okay. So it's sort of, it has a very... It's a very powerful predictor of health in many different ways. So that's what I would consider nature immersion or exposure, is just simply spending time or doing activities in nature.
Sure.
So the connectedness, the degree to which you feel like you're part of the natural environment, is also feeding into that.
Interesting. Thanks for clarifying.
Yeah.
Mm. Wow. Have you got any kind of experiences on a personal level that stand out for you where that has been the case, where you've experienced this kind of experiential thing that you're talking about, the connection with nature?
I mean, do you know what? I think because I know some amazing case studies from friends and also strangers that have spoken to me about this. Mm. Like after a single psychedelic experience, it's completely changed their relationship to nature in a deep and fundamental way. And the interesting thing about it was like one of the case studies, my friends, like she was happy with a lot previous to that. Like she was a happy urbanite, a content urbanite.
Yeah.
And she had her first psychedelic experience and it completely like changed her values in a fundamental way. So she quit her job that she was doing there. She went and did a master's in ethnobotany and she's now like a key player in the psychedelic field, and one of my colleagues from the Beckley Foundation, and now she's living in the countryside in a cottage because she wants to sort of be in nature. And I've heard many other sort of accounts of this. I've always been really connected to nature anyway. Do you know what I mean?
I mean, this is the point, right? It's like you don't need these things.
No, you don't.
There are many ways to engage and connect with nature.
No, very, very much so.
But what we're talking about is they are tools. Like it's changing the way people see them, right? It's like they're not just drugs to get off your face with. There's a whole other side.
No, they go much deeper than that. And to just sort of pass them off on that, you've definitely not done your research or you don't know what you're talking about because there's just much deeper aspects to them than that. Yes, they can be used as that, and some people solely use them for that maybe, but there's much deeper potential there. And no, absolutely, like your nature connection is like very much facilitated by just being in nature and sort of engaging with the you know, sensorially engaging with it and finding beauty and meaning in it as well. They seem to be important mediators of that connection to nature. So no, we absolutely don't need psychedelics. The value I see in psychedelics, and this is kind of going out on a bit of a limb because we need to do more research, but right. The study we published last month kind of hinted towards it.
Is this available online?
Yes, it is.
I'll put some links up at the end.
Cool. What I think's the potential of psychedelics. So basically, if you've, you know, I've pretty much my whole life, apart from my first like year or two, I've lived in the countryside with nature on my doorstep. And I feel very lucky for having had that. But obviously not everyone does have that. Mm. Some people live in really urbanized, nature deprived environments. Mm. And it seems that one's connection to nature is partly predicted by childhood exposure to nature.
Right.
So if you've not had that contact with nature growing up, you might not have it later in life to your loss and its loss as well, because you're not going to want to preserve or protect it.
Yeah.
So the potential role I see of psychedelics, having talked to people about it and some of the sort of data that we got from people who were psychedelic naive, so never having taken one.
And was the study kind of based on people who had various amounts of experience?
Like exactly, yeah. So if I were to come to do a new study, which I'm sort of trying to plan actually, I would want to use entirely or predominantly psychedelic naive people, because we did find a quite strong effect of prior lifetime psychedelic use on their nature relatedness level at baseline.
Okay.
But there was a clear thing for people who had no psychedelic experience. There was quite a large jump post psychedelic. So I feel that the potential of psychedelics could be to reconnect people to nature who've been lacking a connection in a deep way, maybe because of the situation of their upbringing and a lack of nature exposure. But it can kind of make up for that lost connection quite radically and powerfully and quickly.
Really boost it.
Yeah. So that's where I think they could have a good role to play, I think.
So so you mentioned the kind of the current psychedelic research that's going on and the things that you're a part of, like Imperial and Beckley Foundation, and you know, we keep hearing people say it's like there's a bit of a psychedelic research renaissance at the moment. And would you agree with that, and where do you see it going?
Very much so.
Where do you see it going in the next kind of 5 years, let's say?
Very much so that we're in the mix of a psychedelic renaissance. There was two papers published in this last week within a few days of each other, interestingly both looking at naturalistic use of psychedelics. So people taking psychedelics in the wild.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the studies was headed by a guy at Yale and was published in quite a high level journal. And it was like over 4 years, they were looking at people taking psychedelics at festivals and stuff like that. And they found that people taking psychedelics in the wild in festival environments were having transformative experiences.
Okay.
And this was resulting in a kind of enduring feelings of social connectedness. So very much mirroring what's been seen in clinical studies.
Okay, yeah.
So, which was interesting.
Yeah.
And then the other study was looking at levels of addiction, like self-reported, again, like a survey. This is a survey study, I think. And it was finding that, naturalistic psychedelic use was associated with lower cannabis stimulant and opioid misuse, which is interesting. So, we're absolutely now in this renaissance, and it's an interesting time. Like, I think there's a few things shifting now at the same time. So we're seeing in the States, we're seeing the decriminalization movement is sort of beginning to open up. So, you know, like Oakland and Denver, there's a few cities that have either decriminalized psilocybin mushrooms or like in the case of Oakland, all organic psychedelics.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Is that a recent one?
Yeah. Well, yeah. So it's like a few months ago now.
I didn't realize they had all psychedelics.
Yeah, no, it was a step up.
Wow.
So the Denver, the vote was just...
I remember they just got it in Colorado,
It's funny because I remember like when I was working at the Beckley, I was keeping an eye on it at the developments, like, and then I had to go to bed because it was getting really late. But when I went to bed... The media had reported that the vote hadn't passed, like it had been close, but apparently the media had reported on it too early, and by doing so they kind of prompted like the some young voters to get out and vote.
Amazing.
And it kind of swung it the other way just by a few thousand votes. So that I was amazed it was as close as it was, let alone it actually passing. I mean, that was like, so, but then the Oakland one was a big step up in that it was not just mushrooms, but all organic psychedelics. And it was a unanimous decision, like council decision.
Wow.
And the people giving testimony were, they were kind of using the scientific evidence as well as their own transformational experiences to sort of like as evidence, basically. So
there's things are definitely moving.
So things are definitely shifting up. Speaking to someone in the US who's sort of involved with this stuff, he thinks the city is interesting, and it definitely belies a deep cultural shift going on. But the next big step up will be statewide decriminalization. And that needs to happen because right now the state and federal law, they supersede what's going on in those cities.
Yeah.
So it's kind of an uneasy sort of like gray area.
They're having this whole thing with cannabis at the moment, aren't they?
Yeah.
There's so much statewide legality, but the federal level's just kind of like still illegal.
Yeah.
Although
that seems to be also, I think there's been some very recent stuff and they are looking to like to change that and sort of take the DEA's power away from sort of, so things are shifting in an interesting way. So there's that stuff going on. And then there's the medicalization and the sort of like the official clinical stuff. So what's going to probably happen here in the UK, and this is according to some of the guys, the team at Imperial, is within the next 5 to 10 years, psilocybin will be rescheduled from a Schedule 1 to a Schedule 2 drug. And it will be used in particular for major depression.
Right.
That would be it. And that's likely to be the case in the US as well. But the rescheduling, so it's the same actually, although the scheduling systems may be slightly similar, slightly different. Like it's a Schedule 1 on both sides of the Atlantic, so the strictest classification that exists.
Yes.
So just to put it in perspective, like here in the UK, so psilocybin is a Class A Schedule 1 drug. And so obviously the Class A kind of, the class system is sort of governing recreational use, and then the scheduling system is looking at medical scientific use.
Okay, right.
And a Schedule 1 drug, so heroin or diamorphine, cocaine, methamphetamine are all Schedule 2 drugs. So they're really, if you're a medical doctor or a researcher, they're not particularly hard to access and use. Mm. Whereas the psychedelics are Schedule 1 drugs, and it's a big step up.
Mm.
So it's sort of, there's a lot of like regulatory hurdles involved, a lot of cost involved. The place that holds them has its special license. It has to be kept in a special safe, and it has to be weighed, I think, daily with CCT cameras recording what's going on. It's like basically you're handling radioactive isotopes or something. It's extremely strict and very prohibitive about what you can do. It can only be used in strict clinical monitored situations. So when it's rescheduled as a Schedule 2 and used for depression, it will really open things up, and it will allow a lot more off-label prescriptions for related conditions.
But there's already been studies on multiple different use cases, right? Because we're talking, the famous study with prisoners and reoffending rates.
Yeah.
There's end of life kind of stuff.
Yeah. And I'm also really interested in the end of life applications for it as well. Mm. So the strength of the scientific evidence, of the robustness of the findings, is stronger for psilocybin for palliative care for existential end of life than anything else by a fair margin. Mm. It's particularly good at that. And there's just been a follow-up study actually for the study on this they did at New York University. And they found that as much as like 4.5 years later, the surviving participants in that trial still reported like significant reductions in anxiety and depression and like enduring positive effects. They still considered it one of the most important, profound things that had happened to them, and still felt they were really benefiting from that experience. So that's amazing. And that was from a single experience as well. That's the other amazing thing. So
it can last that long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's an important point, you know, that this is why psychedelics are very radical and paradigm shifting compared to existing medications and psychiatric treatments. You know, they're all of those are active for the duration they're in your system.
Yeah.
And once they're out of your system, they stop being active.
Yeah.
Psychedelics are completely different in that, you know, you have this usually fairly good dose in a supportive therapeutic context, and you have this profound experience of consciousness change. And that then sort of alters your perspectives on your life, and in this particular case, on your death.
Mm.
And then you take that perspective shift is so visceral and so powerful that you take it with you back to the cold sober light of day. Mm. Particularly with follow up, obviously, integration work as well, which is important.
Oh yeah.
So it offers a whole new paradigm for psychiatry, for medicine.
A lot of people are very excited about the potential.
Yeah. Because a lot of there's, you know, some conditions like, so existential anxiety, like major depression, addiction, post-traumatic stress disorder, we just don't really have any really effective, reliable therapies or medications or treatments for these conditions.
Yeah,
we can at best manage the symptoms.
Yeah.
You know, we just prescribe like antidepressants, anti-anxiety things. So we try and manage the symptoms, but we've not really got many effective treatments or forms of therapy that sort of really like go to the roots of those issues and can address things at that level.
Sure.
And psychedelics with therapeutic support can potentially do that.
And it looks like MDMA is going to be available in the States.
I think MDMA is probably going to, I think MDMA is going to be before psilocybin in terms of, so yeah, the evidence for that, for treating post-traumatic stress disorder is pretty solid.
Seems really strong. Yeah.
And I think the FDA actually have literally just a few days ago, half a week ago, sort of granted expanded access.
I read something about that. Yeah.
So yeah, that's on the cusp of becoming a kind of integrated treatment, which is needed in terms of, I think, like the amount of suicides from military veterans and others, like it's a really tough thing to live with, PTSD.
Mm.
So having effective treatments available is really going to change lives.
Yeah, for sure. It's an exciting time.
Yeah, no, it really is. It really is an exciting time. And it's a good thing to remember, like, you know, because there's a lot of like bad, not very good stuff happening in the world. And like, do you know what I mean?
As an ecologist, how are you feeling about the way the world is at the moment and the kind of predictions of all sorts of things? There's a lot of paradox in everyday life at the moment. There's like there's a great article that I was reading recently about how to live like the world is ending, and they were like running all their decisions and things by these kind of four sort of areas of, okay, act like I'm gonna die, act like I might not die, act like everything's gonna be okay, and act like everything, you know, we're not sure.
Yeah.
And just kind of like trying to hold all of that at the same time in all of your daily stuff. And it's like kind of like, I think you need to have a level of acting as if things are gonna be okay to just keep your own mental health and your own momentum moving forwards to a degree.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm definitely like, I mean, if you look at the science of the situation we're in, you know, it's widely acknowledged, but we're in a mass extinction event right now that we're orchestrating. There was this big report published early last year, the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Ecosystem Services and Biodiversity. And it was like a huge, very comprehensive report and authored by, I think, like 50 different countries sort of chipped in, 145, I think. This report didn't paint a very positive picture in respect that, worldwide loss of species and degradation of ecosystems is unprecedented and accelerating. It's not only getting worse, but it's getting worse faster all the time.
Mm.
And the sort of conclusion of this study was like, without a global ecological mobilization on the scale of World War II, we're in deep, deep trouble. That's sort of like, but there was a few interesting points in terms of like areas under the management of indigenous groups are not in some cases degrading at all.
Yeah.
And this is interesting because I think it ties into people's connection to nature.
Yeah.
So a lot of these indigenous groups, they have a less individualistic existence than us in the West. It's more of a group community reference existence, and they they have this very strong connection to their surrounding environment and to nature. And they tend to sort of, a reoccurring perspective is the view that, yeah, your environment is part of you. So to harm it is harming yourself. And like, yeah, I mean, and ecologically, that's pretty a sound perspective.
And also in a psychedelic experience, you could say, you know, the dissolution of the
absolutely.
Separateness, I from the external, and actually I am part of everything. Yes. This whole kind of feeling. That you can experience.
Yeah. Well, no, that's a very good point in that we found repeatedly from some of the correlative studies and in the study we recently published that one of the key mediators of this connection to nature is that ego dissolution experience. It is that, yeah, perspective of your sense of individual self sort of dissolving and breaking down and you feeling like you're connecting with the earth or with the universe. And it's that sort of can be a very powerful visceral experience, and that really stays
and
with
a force
you.
For change, right?
Yeah,
potentially. Again.
Potentially, yeah. Absolutely. Like, I mean, I'm really wanting to sort of like. So right now, obviously, given the limitations of being able to use psychedelics outside of a clinical monitored environment, like my next sort of idea for a study is to do it in the Netherlands, where truffles are legal, and compare the effects of nature-based forested settings with like cozy indoor settings.
That's really interesting. I've not heard of anyone do that.
No, it's not being looked at at all, which is amazing to me because like, obviously I massively respect the clinical approach and need to do it, you know, safely and by the book. And but it's like, you know,
can't really avoid the medicalization.
I'm a little bit where I think it would be a shame if psychedelics were only a medical mental health treatment option. And that's all they are. Cause they have so much more potential than that alone. So I'm really interested to get them out of the clinic and the lab and get them out into
nature.
That'd
be fascinating because both of those settings are, you know, generally prescribed as positive and conducive settings.
Yeah.
It'd be really interesting to see what data you got.
I think so.
Yeah.
In terms of, we know from the paper we just published that, so people reporting back to us, there were two measures of like, did you have access to a natural setting during your experience?
This is on the study that just came out.
We kind of asked people like, did you have access to a natural setting during your acute experience, and how much do you rate that as being important to your experience in terms of how it affected the experience? And it was pretty definitive that, as well as the ego dissolution experience, as one might expect, access to natural settings was a positive predictor of short and long-term nature relatedness or connection increase. So I think, but obviously the issue there is the limitation of the study being, you know, just an observational survey study, like, is we don't have detailed knowledge of the natural settings those people have access to. So to get a clearer scientific picture, we need control. We need to know what those natural settings are to be able to compare. So I'm really interested in, not only how does it affect people's connection to nature, their pro-environmental values and stuff, but like, how does it change parameters of the psychedelic experience itself, having one outside in a natural setting versus a sort of, more indoor, but cozy
and
setting.
The kind of,
because that's not been looked at either.
No.
And that's a whole other interesting sort of thing to look at. And the experience of awe is it's coming sort of into the limelight that, it seems that the experience of awe is quite an important mediator of some of the benefits of psychedelics. Like, experiencing awe is associated with increases in pro-sociality, sort of intent to benefit others, and well-being. And they're both facets, aspects of the psychedelic experience, and also the overview effect that the astronauts experience when viewing the Earth from space.
Yeah.
And awe is a big mediator of that, and they have similar kind of after effects actually to psychedelic experiences in some respects. So I'm really interested to compare the levels of awe, because obviously, and awe, sorry, is also very much associated with natural environments as well, being in nature.
Mm.
So how does the experience of awe vary between nature and natural environments and indoor settings?
Yeah, because it'd be like my sort of initial reaction is indoors, you're kind of, you maybe you you shut off the external stimuli a bit and you can go deeper into yourself, and it's more of a psychological, emotional journey versus an external kind of...
I very much would resonate with that view. And so I think the inside setting is great for inner work. I think I think it's overall... For deep therapeutic work, it seems to make sense because you want to go inwards. And like, the whole experience is tailored for that, you know? Like there's the carefully selected playlist to sort of take people through the different phases of the experience. You're lying down and you're wearing eye shades and you're actively encouraged to
and
go
you're
inwards.
Warm and cozy.
Yeah.
Womb-like.
Yeah. No, exactly. So, and then obviously, like outside is a different... So obviously you're not fully in charge of the setting outside. So it's a little bit dependent on the weather and stuff like that. Mm. But yeah, I think it's sort of, there's something about, it's going to likely be a much more kind of open external experience that kind of sort of more take you out of yourself, I think.
Mm.
So it's definitely a different type of experience, but it's got its own value, I think.
So this is something you're planning in the planning stages of?
This is very early, early stages in terms of like, I've spoken to some of the researchers at Imperial in the group there. I've got David Luke actually at Greenwich. I know the guy Martijn, who's co-founder of Synthesis Retreat in the Netherlands, who's a great guy, and I've spoken to this Professor Jan Raymakers at Maastricht University. He's got experience of working with truffles, and also he will know, obviously has in-depth knowledge of the Dutch regulations around this, and it's actually his recommendation that this would be the best idea for a first study using truffles, like rather than doing a proper placebo controlled lab versus outdoor with GMP grade psilocybin, which it's going to be quite a lot more expensive, and it's going to take some time to convince the Dutch authorities that's okay. Whereas the truffles are already sort of it's accessible.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, well, wouldn't it be amazing to do that and then compare different psychedelics with that data as well?
Like, yeah.
Because some of them, I guess, tend towards an internal experience, perhaps more so than an external experience, you know, in my personal.
Yes. I'm curious about that as well. I mean, David Luke actually did a sort of early survey study on this, looking at different psychedelics and nature connection and also the ecological concern. And of those, psilocybin, ayahuasca and LSD were definitely top of the pile.
Hmm.
But psilocybin by quite a way, actually, for both connection to nature and environmental concern. But that might be partly reflective on just the amount of people using psilocybin compared to psychedelics. So I don't want to make too many grand.
I always feel like mescaline and cacti are a bit ignored in these things.
Yeah.
Because that's a subject close to my heart. And I always hope that people are kind of, it's more difficult to do, I guess, with these studies, due to the preparation and all
sorts. We should talk to Roz. Because I know that she's, there has been a real dearth of research on mescaline and cacti. And I definitely think that it has got its place.
Yeah.
And I'd be curious actually, particularly about the nature connection aspect, because it seems to me it's more of a daytime solar experience, and it's sort of like, it could be like really quite conducive to sort of that.
Speaking personally,
condition.
I've definitely had several very powerful experiences of that kind in the daytime. I mean, I think traditionally some people say there's different schools of thought on whether you should do it at night or in the day.
Really?
I think in the Andes it varies. I know some people that say, oh, it's a daytime, it's a plant of the sun. You go out and you spend the day, you know, and then you come back and kind of process and sleep. And then I've heard of other people doing nighttime ceremonies and working with moon energies and stuff like this.
Okay.
So it's kind of, I guess it's an interesting one. But it'd just be nice to see some more of that.
I agree.
I think it's starting to happen.
Yeah, no, it'd be good to see more of it because it's got its own, I think, kind of like, you know, when LSD first came on the scene and then synthetic psilocybin, they kind of like stole the limelight in terms of they're much more potent substances. You need a lot less to get to the same sort of place or an equivalent
unless
place.
Unless you're using an extraction, it kind of, it that's what I like about these things is that the very nature of it means you have to slow down, you have to prepare, you have it's to kind of a take mindful. A day out of your schedule and probably a day afterwards to integrate. You know, it requires you to almost do it ritually, which is that for me, who's into shamanic work, that seems a match made.
I can see that.
You can't really shortcut. That's what I'm saying.
No. And I think there's something nice as well, you know, like obviously like the clinical model, you know, demands, you know, purified, refined extract, you know, drugs and substances. But there's something like, as you say, the ritualistic kind of mindful approach of preparing the full plant the way it is in nature
and traditional use.
It's nice having that. I particularly like, you know, mescaline's got an extremely ancient historical like spiritual lineage. You know, it's been at least 5,500 years, and so I mean that's quite cool that you're sort of like,
it doesn't Mike Jay call it the first psychedelic
and rightfully so. I think it's the in terms of having evidence now for historical usage, definitely. It's, you know, there's speculation that maybe mushrooms have been used longer, but the evidence for that is, you know, it's debatable. At this time, whereas mescaline, we've got pretty solid evidence that at least 3,500 BC, and also it was the first psychedelic to be extracted and then synthesized and experimented with as well. So it's the first in a few ways.
And used more widely in the kind of social circles and stuff.
It would be nice to sort of, it would be good to see it kind of, get more kind of attention I think, definitely. It is worth, and it's quite, because obviously, you know, the tryptamines have got their own sort of, you know, well, they're all kind of different yet similar, but I find that the cactus, you know, it's the phenethylamine, it's a different chemical family, and it's sort of, it's not, and you know, from reports that I read and sort of our personal experiences of having done it out in Peru, it's like, it's less, it's a bit more, it's powerful, but there's a warmth and a gentleness and a softness to it that is quite different to mushrooms and certainly ayahuasca. Yes. You know what I mean? It's like leagues apart in that way. So for certain people who maybe have got certain types of like mental health issues, and you want something that's a bit more gentle and than some of the other classical psychedelics, I think it's definitely can have its place.
Yeah, I found it's kind of controllable to a degree where you can sort of step back and step in in a way that I haven't experienced with other substances.
Once you have a big dose of those, it's kind of you're in, buy the ticket, take the ride.
Exactly. Fascinating. I was going to ask you about neuroplasticity as well. Which seems to be a bit of a buzzword at the moment. Lots of people are very interested in this stuff, and it's not a new thing, but it's becoming more widely talked about, I guess. Because especially in the context of the climate crisis that we're in the middle of, there's this idea that as your brain ages, the plasticity of the neurons and your ability to kind of process change and accept change and be proactive and that kind of stuff, it declines. And things like psilocybin, we've seen now that there's plenty of studies talking about, and not just psilocybin, like the classical psychedelics, I think, as well. They're saying that all of these substances can increase the growth rate of neurons and the way that they're connecting in the brain. And what's your kind of your understanding of all this stuff?
So, this is really interesting to me. Like, I think the first time I spoke at Breaking Convention, I talked about neurogenesis and neuroplasticity in psychedelics. And it was before it was really... It seemed to be, it was quite a few, it was like a decade or something ago. It was before the sort of like, now it's talked about quite a lot, you know. But then there wasn't that many people talking about it.
How would you come to it then at that point?
I think I was kind of just interested in the brain generally. And I had been looking into the effects of exercise and meditation and learning and all these things that sort of like... increase, you know, or augment neuroplasticity and brain change. And now I think it's really interesting. I think it's a kind of like, it's a new frontier now. It's interesting because there's a very much a divide in modern neuroscience now in terms of like some scientists strongly think that throughout the adult lifespan, there are new like neuronal stem cells are turning into neurons and sort of like in certain key brain areas and feeding it and sort of fusing into our brain. And there are other researchers who don't share that view. I think like once we reach adulthood and our brains stop growing, that's essentially it. So it seems to be, but from the research I've seen, it seems to be more in the former camp that neurogenesis does continue through our lifespan. And also, yeah, neuroplasticity. I mean, it has to sort of for us to learn and adapt to new experiences. But yeah, one of the interesting capacities of psychedelics is their ability to alter personality in certain ways. So from early research on psilocybin, it was found to, that it could increase openness. And I think this is interesting. If you're looking at it like this, and obviously now there's ongoing research at Imperial actually looking at using MRIs to look at brain change after a single psilocybin experience in someone who's never had a psychedelic experience before. So they're doing all these psychological assessments to see how people's values and views and personality and that those things have changed, but also the actual like physical layout of the brain.
Wow.
So I think when we're getting these, I think when we're sort of detecting these changes in personality and values and stuff, that they might be the tip of the iceberg for the neuroplasticity that's changes that are going on underneath. But one of the interesting things they found, there's a study, I think from 2018, looking at personality changes in people undergoing psilocybin therapy, and two particularly interesting things. Firstly, this increase in openness. So openness is one of the big five measures of personality. And it's the only one, it's associated with things like imagination, appreciation for aesthetics, openness to new experiences, hunger for knowledge, and appreciation for the views and values of others.
Empathy.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's quite a few interesting sub-categories that are sort of fall
it's
under
a broad,
it.
Yeah, it's a broad word, right?
But it seems like, so people, there's been a number of correlative studies that psychedelic users tend to rate more highly in openness anyway. But it was a bit of a kind of chicken or egg scenario where it was like, were they that open before the psychedelic and being drawn to it, or was it the psychedelic making them? So, but now there's been some causative studies that show there is this increase in openness. And it's associated as well with a few different cognitive abilities, unlike the other personality traits. And interestingly, cognitive reserve, which is a really interesting and important thing for as we age and go through cognitive decline and also buffering against neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's.
This is a new one to me, cognitive reserve.
Yeah. Oh, so there's a really interesting study I highly recommend you look up on nuns. And it was looking at the brains of nuns that had died. And it was comparing, and it was looking at, so there were nuns who didn't really play games or read or sort of that were that engaging in that sense. And then there were nuns who actively played games, were other nuns and read and sort of like were more mentally sort of agile in their twilight years. And looking at the brain, looking at the layout of the brain, it was really interesting in that. So some of the nuns' brains, who by the looks of it had quite advanced, I think, Alzheimer's or dementia, I think they were looking at. From the look out of the brain, you would have said that's a quite damaged brain.
Yeah.
But in the nuns that were sort of actively, sort of cognitively exercising, like they were in remarkably good shape and actually performing better than the nuns whose brains didn't seem as in bad a shape. So that's another weird thing, is like the physical layout of the brain is not always a barometer for sort of like your level of cognition. So it was a very interesting, revealing study, but it seems openness is associated with cognitive reserve, and that is important for cognitive decline and kind of buffering against neurodegenerative diseases. And we and openness is generally, before this research, it was generally thought to be fixed by the age of 30, and that's it. And if anything, maybe declining slightly as we age.
Oh, wow.
So being able to kind of like robustly potentially increase it is really important. The other really interesting thing from this study by the Imperial Group from a few years ago was this decrease in neuroticism. So neuroticism is a very different personality trait in that it is a strong predictor of many different psychological and physical maladies and illnesses. And it's a strong predictor, I think, again, of Alzheimer's, actually. And like, it's such a strong predictor that there's kind of increasing interest in, like, it may be actually be a sort of manifesting agent. And apparently when people do get Alzheimer's, there's this quite noticeable jump in their neuroticism level. So through the psilocybin therapy, there was this significant increase in openness, and then this significant decrease at the same time in neuroticism. And there was changes, I think, to extroversion as well. There was a big increase in conscientiousness to a small degree. So there's these shifts in personality types to some degree, but potentially in quite a beneficial way.
Yeah, I mean, they all sound positive to me.
I mean, I think it's really interesting, and it's not something that has got that, doesn't seem to have that much attention right now in the psychedelic arena. Is this the implications of this personality change, what it means to people's long-term physical mental health? And I think it's
what
an
they
interesting
do with their
frontier
lives, you know? It could impact all sorts of stuff.
Very much so. And that, you know, people do report these things after like a pivotal psychedelic experience, like it puts their life on a different path and changes them. So people do report these deep
dramatic
dramatic kind of changes to their life trajectory.
Wow, there's so much potential for this stuff. I mean, it's really exciting to think about how this might look in the future, and how these treatments might emerge. It's just a case of really hoping that the governments listen to this research and are kind of open to evolving.
I think maybe our government will drag its frickin' boots and take its time. But I think the cat is out of the bag now.
Sure.
And there's an irresistible tide of scientific evidence that's mounting up all the time. And, you know, especially like in the States, the Pentagon are now actively interested in using MDMA therapy. And like same with the firemen.
So once
and the
it becomes
force,
institutions.
It's sort of like it's becoming and like, you know, military veterans who might be suicidal, nothing's been able to help them. And then they've had some psychedelic session. It's done more good than anything else has. So there's a groundswell of like support now, both scientific and sort of like more, I guess, anecdotal and personal. And I think it's too late to kind of reverse that. So, I mean, you know, we'll see sort of how it plays out kind of this time. But I think they are going to be integrated like therapeutic medical tools. And hopefully, but as we were talking about earlier, hopefully more than that as well.
Yeah. So what does the rest of the year look like for you this year? What have you got going on?
Well, you know what? Good question. Like right now, to be honest, I'm kind of in a period of like career/life transition. Mm-hmm. So I'm doing some content writing. I'm doing some book editing at the current time. I'm trying to convert some of my PhD thesis chapters into actual papers, which I should have done ages ago, but I'm really trying to crack on with that. And then I'm applying for jobs and sort of trying to kind of like figure out my future path. Either I'm going to go back more in an ecology direction, and which is kind of obviously, my original background and kind of first love, or I'm going to try and sort of in some capacity move forward with this this psychedelic nature connection research, because I'm really passionate about that. And I had another idea for a study I really want to see to be a part of or try and make happen. There's this interesting article in The Guardian about the Trees for Life, this organization.
I know them.
Scotland doing great work. Reforesting, and they're planting this big native forest in the south of Scotland. And they've got this cool program, the Rewild and Recover program, and it's free for people people like homeless people, addicts, people who've got mental health issues.
Oh wow, that's so good.
The particular case study in The Guardian was an asylum seeker from Ecuador who had a like traumatic trauma in his past, and it was following his experience of attending this tree planting thing in the wilds of Scotland for a week or two, and I'm really benefiting from it in a powerful way by the sound of it. And I'm really there's a huge body of scientific literature on the affect the mental and physical health effects, well-being effects of both connection to nature and being in nature, mm-hmm. nature immersion. And they're mm-hmm. actually, they are two separate things, right? Right. With a lot of overlap, but they're actually two. So, but I'm particularly interested in like the applied ecological restoration work. So like actually like planting these trees and restoring nature.
Mm.
And in a sense, kind of restoring ourselves because we are part of that, we're sure. restoring. And I'm thinking, yeah, it links up my kind of interest, my new interest in this, I guess the psychedelic mental health stuff, but also the ecological restoration stuff. So I'm really keen to try and make that happen this year if I can. Wow. So
you got a lot going on.
Yeah, well, yeah, a little bit. Like not much money, but ideas.
I wanted to ask you about the RAIN project and your involvement with that and how that's kind of that's going.
So yeah, this is the brainchild of my good friend Danny Nemo. So yeah, Danny set this up. So his partner, his wife is Brazilian. And he's been over to Brazil, in this particular part of Minas Gerais in Brazil. And sort of the locals there have noticed it's been getting drier and drier, and the rivers were drying up where he'd been swimming in them before and not coming back. So, and the people there had noticed a change, and like it seemed to be coinciding with deforestation there.
Mm.
And obviously they were worried, and Danny's very ecologically conscious, and he was worried. So yeah, he set up. It was called Taramin, is now called RAIN. So that's the Regenerative Agroforestry Impact Network. And I helped a little bit with Taramin in its previous incarnation in terms of doing a bit of, content and stuff for the initial website. So I've not had much involvement in its current form, but it's just got like a great revamped, very shiny looking website. It's looking really, really good. And the group of, the team of people Danny's assembled to work on it and with it are really good. So he's got some good collaborators in Brazil, and they're effectively seeding reforestation projects in that part of Brazil, looking to expand, but also they're championing this very interesting form of agroforestry called syntropic agroforestry. And it's kind of modeled on natural succession and natural ecosystem function. So I think you effectively like you grow lots of many different native species to start with, and you're kind of growing vegetables on the ground, but you're also growing fruit trees as well, fruit and nut trees. I think initially actually they use eucalypts, which haven't got like, don't sound like a good sort of ecologically friendly plant, but they use them with a purpose, and they grow because they're really fast growing. Mm. So they grow these eucalypts, and then they put the leaf and wood matter into the soil to mulch the soil to increase the organic matter in the soil.
So they don't use animals?
No. So no, the interesting thing about it is there's no pesticides or fertilizer use. And it's like, if there is any pest outbreaks, the blame kind of falls on you for something has gone wrong with that system. So you know, the way you've sort of done it is at fault rather than the pests being at fault.
Yeah.
So yeah, it uses all these different species, very kind of low input. And there's an amazing footage of this. It was this Swedish agronomist who moved to Brazil in 1984, Ernst Grosch, I think, who came up with it. And there's an interesting photo taken from a helicopter of like of his plot of land next to the Atlantic dry forest. And you just can't tell where the forest ends and where his plot begins. It just looks the same.
Wow.
And he's noticed since he's done it that rivers have started flowing again, and springs have started flowing again in the land that have been long dry. And I've heard there's other cases of that where there's been reforestation projects in Brazil, like springs and rivers start flowing. And obviously because the trees are drawing up water from way down the water table. But then obviously like tree, because of all their evapotranspiration, as we know, like rainforest in particular, but also other forests, they effectively make their own weather for the amount of water they're putting up.
Right.
So, and that seems to have happened in Brazil, is that there's been, because the trees have gone, they're not getting the rain. And obviously, so it is motivating change there. So it's a really good organization. And I do, moving forward, I do want to do more, hopefully more outreach and engagement work with and for them, because they're looking for volunteer support. They're also looking for donations and financial support, but like I have, yeah, lots of faith in Danny that he's a good guy of integrity, and like that money's going to go to where it's needed to do the best good. So yeah, great initiative, great project.
I'll put the link to the Rain Project where cool. you can go and have a read about all this and perhaps donate and
nice
in the blog post. But yeah, I think we'll call it for now, Sam. Thank you so much for your time and energy on a grey Saturday afternoon. I really appreciate it.
No, I really appreciate it's been really nice chatting to you. Thanks for coming all this way.
Is there any way you direct people onto the internet to look at, if you can see, I mean, your talks, we've talked about the talks at Breaking Convention. I think they're all on YouTube.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have my own site or my own blog or anything like that, but yeah. I'm not a hard, there's lots of me kind of going on in terms of like talks and articles and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of around and about. Yeah, I've got a few different things publish elsewhere, and I talk fairly sort of regularly, particularly in London these days, but I'm not a hard guy to track down for, you know, social media channels or online. So
great, that's great. Yeah. Well, yeah, please go, and if you're interested in anything Sam said today, please go and check out more of his work. I'm sure you'll be as fascinated by viewing some of that as hopefully you have been today. Thank you very much, mate. Thank you.
Cool. Thank you, Jody. We found out.